I'm going to introduce you to Joe.
You know, you can't be a beacon if your light don't shine. And there's a lot of beacons in this room tonight, I can tell by your eyes. My name's Joe Hudson. I'm an alcoholic. I go to most of my meetings. I go to them in the state of Texas. Texarkana is right on the border, you know. And in Texas, if you don't give your sobriety date, they don't want you to talk. Because they don't want nobody talking in their meetings that don't have a sobriety date. So I give my sobriety date because that's what I've been doing for the last 28 years since I've been going to meetings in Texas. My sobriety date is January the 12th, 1969. Now, I come in and I come in the program in Las Vegas. We didn't give sobriety dates there because they thought that was bragging if you give your sobriety date. I do want to thank the committee for inviting me here. It's been a great weekend, and I have met many, many people that I would never have met had you not invited me, and I thank you very kindly. And to see somebody like Joey, you know, didn't he look cleaned up here tonight? I mean, a young man, I think he can, you know, I think that boy can be a beacon for a long, long time, because his light's going to shine. But you know, when I come into the program, back there in 1969, I didn't know how to stay sober. I had no idea of what to do. And it makes me think of a story that I heard about this oil man down in Fort Worth, Texas. And he wanted to raise cattle. He wanted to retire from the oil business. And he bought him, come up into Arkansas and bought him a ranch. He bought 2 acres. And bought him 2 cows and put them out there. And after about 2 years, well, he had 2 fat cows. And the farm agent come by one day and he said, "When am I going to have some calves?" He said, "Well, you got to have a bull if you want calves." And he took his 2 cows to market the next day and traded them for a bull. So that's about what I knew about staying sober. About as much as he did about raising cows. But tonight I want to talk to you about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I had a lot of fear. I doubt if anybody in this room had any fear. I had enough fear to fill this room for everybody in here. But I didn't have enough of faith to stay sober 124 hours. I had a lot of guilt. I don't know whether anybody else had any guilt or not, but I had some guilt. And I had some remorse. Thank goodness that Mike talked about the church last night. Born and raised down in Rutherford County in North Carolina. And when you talked about the church down there, you talked about the Baptist church, the Southern Baptist. And I got about the same results as he did. I just got wet whenever they put me under. And that's about all that happened. But anyway, I was down there till I went into service, and I come back, and I'd got married just before I went overseas, and my wife was an asthmatic, and we moved to Phoenix, Arizona, and lived down there for about 16 years. And this is where I caught my alcoholism, is down in Phoenix. They had a lot of it running around down there in those bars. But let me tell you about my first drink. And Kay mentioned this morning about the bootleggers. And see, Rutherford County was dry until just a few years ago. They had enough bootleggers and church people that they kept it all voted out. But it was dry. But most of us knew, us boys, we knew the bootleggers. And we knew the drunkards. Hell, you weren't alcoholics. We weren't alcoholics whenever I was coming up. We was drunkards. And one Sunday afternoon, there was 2 other boys and myself. We was about, 13 or 14 years old. And we was out in the woods looking for some muscadines. And we saw the bootlegger. We saw him pull up on a little road and saw him jump out of his car and went down to a stump hole and put something in it and jumped back in his car and he left. Well, we went down to see what it was. And I tell you what, that was a quart of the clearest stuff I've ever seen. And we opened it up and we smelled it. And then we dared each other to take a drink. Now, I'll tell you what, whenever I put that down, it come back up through my eyes, my ears, my nose. That was the darndest thing. And by the time we was finished and all of us had to take a little drink, we had wasted a little bit. And we knew we had to fill it up, and we weren't close to a creek. And we filled it up. And it wasn't near as clear whenever we put it back in as it was when we took it out. And then we had to wait to see who come to pick it up. And we saw them who picked it up. I'm sure that they had a little discussion over that quart of moonshine. But I didn't want to drink, and I really did not drink until I was 30 years old. I'd had a few beers along the way, but I didn't drink. And I was born and I was raised in a family that didn't drink and went to church and done all of those things. And of course, if you heard Mike last night, you heard my story about going to church. But when I got to Phoenix, I went with a company and went up in this company very fast. We got out there in 1948. And by 1950, I had been made a vice president in the largest grocery firm in the state of Arizona at that time. These people started entertaining me with some alcohol. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you tonight I was an alcoholic from my first drink. I had to drink myself into it. I might change my mind because things are coming back a little clearer, and I'll go a little bit further back. I used to think I was only alcoholic a year before I come in the program, but it goes back quite a little bit further than that now. I know that I had a firm there. We'd started a rag job in the company, and I had a great promoter in the company, and I had to be put in the hospital. In fact, it's the only time I can ever remember being in the hospital, period, after I got back from overseas. And I was in there a second day, and I called him, and I said, "Hoagie, I got to have a drink. And I don't know how you're going to get it in here." Now, I had already changed over to vodka. And about an hour and a half later, he come in with four oranges. And I said, "Hell, I told you I wanted a drink." He said, "Eat the oranges. There's a half a pint of vodka in those four oranges." So you know, whenever we need a drink, we're going to get a drink some way, somehow. And as far as I know, that's the last time that I was in the hospital, and thank goodness that I haven't had to be in over the last 33 years for anything. I'm just going to talk to you about what happened to me in my last year or so of drinking. And then I'm going to try to tell you what has happened to me after I had a spiritual experience on the morning of January the 12th, 1969. And then tell you what has happened to me since. And basically all of this has happened to me, what I'll talk to you about after that, is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first wife died in 1966. I remarried again, and living in Las Vegas. I had moved from Phoenix to Las Vegas. Now, there's a good place to go if you be a budding alcoholic. A good place. I'm not too sure. I think I might have had that in the back of my mind whenever I went up there to open up a couple of stores. But all you got to do is go to those casinos and act like you want to play. And they'll just keep bringing those drinks to you, bringing them to you. But when I got remarried, and the lady that I remarried was from Texarkana, and she could outdrink me. Well, I thought, I've got me a good drinking partner. But she quit after a few months, and she started to go in some place that I found out they called it Al-Anon. And by the way, tonight I want to thank the Al-Anon program because you saved my life. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. You saved my life. She said she never did shoot at me to hit me. But I told her that one night I passed the same bullet three times. And I used to walk around and I was sore all the time. I mean, I couldn't figure how I was falling into the furniture like that to keep me sore and blue. And sometimes I had to walk like that. I mean, I couldn't understand it. I thought I was dying of cancer. And you know, I was sober 3 years before I found out what the problem was. When I'd go home drunk and pass out in the living room or bedroom, it didn't make any difference. If she didn't have on those sharp pointed shoes, she'd go put them on. And she would come and just kick the hell out of me. And she didn't pick her spots. Buck knew her, and she had a pretty good temper. But thank God she went to Al-Anon and she changed. She changed a lot. And I appreciate that. And it was, see, I couldn't do any, when I was drinking, I could not do anything. It was in excess. Anything that was different from what I was doing yesterday or last week or I'd never done before. The man that I respected, probably the man next to my father, is a man that owned the company that I went to work for. His name was A.J. Bayless. And in 1966, he died. And I was called and asked to come down and be a honorary pallbearer at his funeral. That morning, that was out of the ordinary, so I made a reservation on the 7 o'clock plane, Las Vegas to Phoenix. And I missed it. I made a reservation for the 8 o'clock plane. I missed it. Now, I got up at 5 o'clock. I called North Las Vegas, and I made a reservation on a private plane, and I missed it. I could not do anything because I had to keep drinking and drinking and drinking it away. So Norma decided, my wife, that she wanted to get me sober this last year, the last year I drank. And Lee's Canyon, if any of you have been to Las Vegas and down there, you know, it's in a valley county and it's up in the mountains and 45 minutes away. You can be up where they ski in the wintertime and where it's nice and it's cool in the summertime. She said, let's go to camp out in Lee's Canyon next weekend. And I said, well, fine. Be happy to. Now, I've got about a week to think about this. It's hot. I'm wearing shorts. And she's going to be checking every move I make. So I come up with the idea that I will let the air out of the spare tire, break it down, and wrap me up some half pints of vodka and put it in that spare tire. And that's what I done. So whenever we left Los Angeles, I wanted her to check me out good, you know, to make sure, I didn't tell her this, but I knew she'd be checking me out. And we went up there, and on the way up, I said, now, I'll carry in the wood and build the fires, and I'll wash the pots and the pans and carry up all the water so you won't have to do anything. Now, naturally, I had to figure it out where I could get a drink when I needed it, which I did. And she couldn't figure out how come I got drunk up there. But I did. Now she said, let's come back up here every weekend. I said, that's fine. I'd like to. Now the next week, I went up there and I took me a dozen half pints of vodka and I hid it all over that place. I knew I would never find all of them, but I'd find some of them. And we did. We spent quite a bit of time up there that year and that summer. But there's another thing that just, you know, I just thought of it. We talk to people, I don't care how long we've been sober, I imagine Liz sometimes goes to a meeting now after 49 years, and somebody will talk about something she hadn't thought about maybe in 25 or 30 years. And there was something that come up, and I thought about when my first wife died, we wasn't expecting it, so we hadn't made any arrangements. And I went to the funeral home, and I was going to put her in a mausoleum. And they were showing me all these caskets and how good and what all the features on them. And after I decided on the mausoleum, then they said, over here's a casket that'll float. Now, this was, they were merchandising me to the as far out of it as you could get. And, you know, I put her in the mausoleum and bought a casket that would float. Now, you know, you're pretty well out of it whenever you get merchandise along that line. So I had a little problem a little bit further back than I thought I did. So one day I might get up here and say, I was an alcoholic from my first drink. I don't know. But I had an experience that almost killed me, and I didn't realize it. I got up one morning to go to work, and the car was dingy. Couldn't hardly see in it. And I opened up the door, and there was a little bit of smoke coming out of the seat of the upholstery, just about the size of your finger. So I run in and got me a little saucepan, and I come back, and I'm going to put it out. Well, the result was I had to get the garden hose, because I thought at first that some kids have come through going to school, and they thought it lit cigarette in my car. Well, by the time I got through tiring out all of the upholstering on that front seat and down to the springs and had water in the floorboard and thought I had it all out, and I thought I'd go to work. So I get me a towel and I put it over my springs and I start to work. And I get about two blocks from the house, and whoa, man, I'm telling you, I'm about to get barbecued. It's burning. So I pulled in a service station and asked them where the closest fire station was. And they talked about my mother and my relatives and told me to get that car off of their parking lot and away from their gas pumps. But they did tell me where the fire station was. I started at the fire station. And when an alcoholic starts to think, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. And I thought, well, if I don't want it to blaze, I won't give it any air. And I rolled up every window as tight as I could get it. And I got to the fire station and opened up that door and rolled out. Got up and staggered in and told them I brought them a fire. And they didn't believe me. And I told another one, fireman, I said, I brought you a fire. He didn't do nothing about it. So the captain come by, and I said, I brought you a fire. He said, where is it? I said, out in the driveway. He went out, and he come running back in. He said, he damn sure did. So they went out, and they put out this fire and told me that I really shouldn't drive. But I told them, they put me some cardboard on the seats, and I went home, and I had to go to the emergency room that afternoon, and they told me at the emergency room that I would be all right by probably 10 or 11 o'clock that night, but another 15 minutes and I'd have been dead. Now, whenever I got to feeling halfway decent that night, what do you think I done? More vodka, and drank till I passed out. Being that close to death, and still, I wouldn't give up. But you know, we can think pretty fast on our feet, and I'm sure all of you in here that's thinking along, you think pretty good when you get into a tight place. I was going home one day for lunch, and I was doing a little speeding. The officer said I was. And he called up and he said, how come? And I said, why are you speeding? I said, my wife's going to have a baby. And he said, when? I said, in 9 months if I can get home fast enough. And And he started to laugh. And he said, go ahead and turn me loose and let me go. So sometimes we can get out of some situations that maybe we shouldn't otherwise. But I tell you, getting into the last stages of my drinking, I was a member of the Satoma Club, Service to Mankind. Now, the only thing I was doing for mankind was it was good for two drinks going, two drinks coming back, and a half pint. It was a noon meeting. And then one day, can you imagine a service club having a meeting and had an alcoholic on the program and an Al-Anon? Can you imagine that? Now, I'm at the stage right at that point that I don't want you talking about my drinking, and I sure don't want to talk about it. And they told us all they come there for was to tell us about the facilities that they had in the area in Las Vegas for men and for women. But they showed a little film, about 10 minutes, of what happens if you be alcoholic. That you take that alcohol in, it goes down, hits the bloodstream, and here comes them little white monkeys, little white dots, that one is too many and a thousand's not enough. And do you know, from that time I saw that little film till I had my last drink, them damn monkeys almost drove me crazy. Because every time I drink them little white monkeys, excuse me, would come up and they would it would hit me. I went back to the store that day and wrote the president a letter and resigned because I wasn't going to go back where they would talk about me. And I felt that they had that meeting just for me. And I didn't want to go back. Now, my car looked like a buzzard. And I didn't know where these tents and all come from, but it just flopped in the breeze. The fenders did just like that, and I never did know where those bumps come from. And one morning, I get up and I look at my car, and I got a great big, it's a white car, and I had a great big blue place on the left fender. And I took it to a body shop. I wanted them to tell me that bump got put on in the parking lot. Now, they gave me a song and dance, and I don't think they told me the truth. I don't think they knew. But they scared me. So I just got back to the store. I still had the Western Auto store, and I had a Ben Franklin store side by side. And there was a gentleman come into my store with a suit of clothes on. Now, I'm at the point now where I don't want, if you come into my store and I don't know you, I want to leave, or I want you to leave. And I heard him ask for me. Now, for a long time, I'd been going with loss of memory. I didn't know you called them blackouts. But I'd been having loss of memory for a long time. I talked to people that I knew their credit wasn't any good, and I had them to fill out a credit application. I'd done all of these things, and this man wouldn't leave. He just walked around there like that, unconcerned. So finally, I had to go over, and I said, can I help you? He said, yes, I want to see you in the back room. And that just scared me to death, because I knew that someday somebody was going to come and put some papers on me for something that I didn't know I'd done. And my legs are just shaking like that as we went to the back room. We get back there, and he reaches down in his pocket. And I said, oh, God, here it comes, here it comes. He said, my name is Don. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, you know, only my wife thinks I drink too much. I can quit anytime I want to. That's exactly what I told him. Now, if anybody tells you that, You're looking right in the eyes of a full-blown alcoholic. A social drinker darn sure don't have to tell you that. He said, if you ever want to quit, give me a call. And turned around and walked out. An alcoholic wearing a suit of clothes. I was familiar with the 3.5% that live on Skid Row, but I didn't know alcoholics wore suits of clothes. And I walked in, watched him walk out of that store, straight as a stick. And then I looked down at his card, Regional Manager, Omaha Life. I said, my God. He said he had only been sober 9 months. And thank God he had, because he was making unsolicited calls. And because of that, I never, till I had my last drunk, I never, every time I'd get drunk, I could see Don walking out of that store, straight as a stick. Those two calls, the Satoma and Don, was two very powerful 12-step calls that stayed in my mind until I had my last drink. I know that I went to church. You know, my wife and my young son, they wouldn't go with me anyplace because my wife had become so unmanageable. They wouldn't even go to church with me. And I knew the reason the church wasn't doing me any good. By the way, I changed from the Baptist church. I knew that's what was keeping me drunk. Because they talked about all of these things that I was doing that you shouldn't do. So I changed, and I changed to the Presbyterians because I knew they drank some. Now, it didn't help one bit, and I'm still a member of the Presbyterian church. It didn't help one bit because if anything you do in excess with them is wrong. So I was going to church that morning. It was in December. It was cold, and they wouldn't go with me, my wife and my son. I said, well, I'll go by myself. I went in, I took a shower and put on the best clothes I had and still felt dirty. And on the way, I didn't take a drink. And on the way, I thought, well, if I just have a half pint under the seat, that will help. And I stopped, and you know, in Las Vegas, you can get whiskey 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I put it under the seat, and they had to have two services. The first service was leaving, and I pulled on for the 11 o'clock service, and I had to lay down in the floorboard and drink half of that half pint before I could go into church. And I knew when I got in there that everybody knew what I'd done before I come in. And I didn't have a dry thread on my shirt. And as I walked back to the car, and I could remember that summer and seeing in Lee's Canyon and seeing these overhanging rocks and where the animals would come down and get under these rocks to get out of the weather. And that's the way I wanted to take my life. I wanted to pack me up a tote sack full of half pints of vodka. See, I'd already graduated all the way down to that quite a long time before I quit. And I was going to take it up there, and I was going to come down and get under those rocks and just drink myself to death. And then I got to thinking, suppose I can't die. I don't want to starve to death. So I'm going to need some Vienna sausage and some crackers and some pork and beans. And I'm trying to get all that together. And you know, I never did get it together because I sobered up before I figured out how to get two tote sacks full of stuff under those rocks. And thank God I did. But see, I had brought Skid Row right into my home and let it run right down through the middle of the bedroom, the living room. So Skid Row can either be on concrete, it can be on carpet. It don't make any difference. It's the same thing. I'm going to tell you about my life's drunk. The morning of January the 11th, and I didn't know this was going to be my last drunk, by no means. I walked out of the house that morning and I said, today I'm not going to drink. And nobody could have meant that any more than I did. I drove 2 blocks and reevaluated that statement and pulled into a liquor store. And I got me a drink. I got me a half pint, and I drank half of it before I could go on to the store and open it up. And my wife, after going to Al-Anon, when I was drinking, she wouldn't come and help me. And then I drank all day. Now, I might tell you, any of you that's still in business, and let me tell you something that's real good for business. It'll close it up for pretty fast. See, when I was drinking, and I was there by myself, and she'd leave, and I thought I had all the business I needed, I'd go lock the door. Now, if you was in there, you was locked in. And if you was out there, you couldn't get in. And a few times, they had to call her to come and let them out. So, I know that my life's drunk that day, she wouldn't come and help me, and I drank off and on all day. That night I was going to a basketball game, and she wouldn't go with me to the convention center. My young son that liked basketball wouldn't go with me. And I said, well, I'll go by myself. And I did. Now, I don't think they throwed me out. It was a college game, and I had to go to the car and drink and come back in. They wouldn't let you have the drinks on the floor. Now, the last thing I can remember is going out. It was sometime between, I know Las Vegas was playing Houston. And I don't know what happened, but anyway, I got mad at the referees. You know, we can get mad at anything when we're drinking. And I went out, and the last thing I remember is taking a drink out of that half pint or finishing it up. The next thing I remember, I'm driving on a lonely road. Now, that's not unusual. Whenever you are in Nevada or Arizona or California and you're in the desert, you don't know where you are till you can find you some kind of a landmark. But this was nighttime. So I'd done that many times. I had come out of a blackout driving and not knowing where I was. So that night, whenever I saw this sign, entrance to the Blue Diamond Mine, I said, what am I doing up here? That's about 25 miles up in the mountains from Las Vegas. I said, well, I'm drunk. I need to pull over. I need to go to sleep. I could always tell when I was drunk because my rear end would get tired and it would go to sleep, and I couldn't tell whether I was sitting or walking. So I knew I needed to pull over and go to sleep. It didn't happen that way. The next thing I remember, I'm looking at the lights over Las Vegas. And I thought, well, I ought to go in. I ought to pull over and go to sleep. But it didn't happen that way. Now, my wife picked me up coming from an Al-Anon meeting. She said I went to the store, to the Western Auto Store, and I had got into a habit of spending a lot of time in the back room there. I had me a cot. And I'd go in, and I'd lock the door, and then I'd put a chain on the inside, and I'd lock that so you couldn't get in. And I felt safe. And she saw me do that, and she said she saw me with that half pint sticking out of my pocket. And she said, well, I'll just go on to the grocery store, and then I'll go home. Now, I do not remember any of this. This is what she told me. But when I got home, I was too drunk to walk. I got out of the car, and I couldn't walk. And I thought, well, I'll crawl in the house. And I couldn't crawl. And I got back in the car, and I passed out. Now, sometime during the night, my wife and youngest son got me out of that car and got me in bed. I do not have any recollection of that whatsoever. But I do know that night that I drove the Las Vegas Strip in a blackout because it was coming and going. I could remember something I could remember from this point to this point. The next morning, when I woke up, I guess it's the moments of clarity that we have. I could see myself for what I was. It was like I had hit a solid wall that I could not go over, I couldn't go around, and I couldn't go under. Now what do I do? I got out of that filthy bed. My wife had moved into the other bedroom several months prior to that, and she had the only key to it, to that door. And I got down on my knees beside of that dirty bed, and I said the simplest prayer I've probably ever said in my life, but one of the most sincere, and it probably lasted 10 seconds, maybe, because I just said, God, take the desire of alcohol from me. I cannot do it myself. I waited a few minutes and I went out to see if I might have hit something with the car. And I couldn't tell because it already had so many dents on it, it looked like that buzzard. But I had bought a half pint of vodka that I'd never opened, and it was laying in the yard, and I picked it up. And I picked up the newspaper. And I walked through the door. And when I walked through the front door, it was like 200 pounds fell off of my shoulders. I set the vodka down, I set the newspaper down, and fell back into that bed and had 3.5 of the most relaxed rest that I'd had for probably years. And from that moment, that's 34 days and 33 years ago today, and I have not had a desire to have a drink of alcohol. And for that, I thank God, because only God could remove that desire. And that I'm very grateful for. That day I laid and watched that third Super Bowl and thought it was the first one. With a contentment, I wasn't as feeling as good that day as I feel tonight, but it was better than I'd felt for a long time, and I had a calmness that I hadn't had for a long time. I knew something had happened. I didn't realize that it was the gift of surrender that had been given to me unwanted. And I had to stay sober in order to find that out. The next night, as my wife was getting ready to go to the Al-Anon meeting, and she didn't know I was going, and I said, I believe if you'll wait a minute, I'll go with you. So I went in and I washed my face and freshened up a little bit. She went to the Al-Anon meeting, and I went into a men's stag meeting. I wasn't an alcoholic. I just told her my name was Joe. Now, about halfway through that meeting, I got mad because it was a call-up meeting. And there was one of those men that got up there and talked about me. And I said, my God, she's been gone every night for a year, and she's been out with every one of them men. She's told them what to say when I got here. And on the way home, I told her. She said, what'd you think about it? I said, didn't think much of it. I might go back once a month, but it's not going to be for me. But there's two things that happened that night that brought me back to my second meeting. It was the laughter that I hear tonight here. It was your eyes. There was something different. And I wanted to go back, and I went back the second night. It was a mixed meeting, and I identified with the women. And I said, my God, she's told them too. But I wasn't an alcoholic. So I went back the third night to a closed meeting and didn't even know what a closed meeting was. But I went back, and when the meeting started, I wasn't an alcoholic. But when it was over, I had not only admitted it, but I had accepted the fact I was an alcoholic. And it's because you people told me what it was like with you. Like I've been trying to tell you what it was like with me. And if you're an alcoholic, I am an alcoholic. And thank God that you told me what it was like. That first year, I made over 450 meetings because I tried to spend as much time going to meetings as I did drinking. And you have to have something to fill that void. And thank God that I could go to meetings almost around the clock in Las Vegas. It's two nights a week I could go to a 2 o'clock in the morning meeting, one at the International Hotel and one on the Strip. I got to doing well. My business improved greatly. All it needed was somebody to run it. Somebody would stay sober. On the 5th of October, 1969, my business was destroyed in the racial disturbances, the riots that they had that you didn't hear about. They did not put those in the newspaper. The media did not carry it. Now, the ones that happened later on, years later, they did. Because Howard Hughes people kept it out of the newspaper. I had to buy all my contracts back from Western Auto. They had bought all these contracts, and I had to buy them all back. It destroyed my businesses. I think I had what I call leftover sale. I had about $5,000 is all I had left. I don't know how much it cost me. I never want to know. Because I know that it broke me flatter than I've ever been broke. The last day I was in there trying to get merchandise out of the store, the first customer that I had with that Western Auto store, her name was Martha Jackson. Martha had bought a coffee stereo. And she called and the telephone rang and I was just ready to, there was some insurance people was there, the policeman was there and they'd wanted me to keep the lights on in the store that they could use for our headquarters. And I answered the phone, and on the other end it said, "This is Martha Jackson, Mr. Hudson, your first customer." And I said, "Yeah, Martha." I said, "How are you today?" She said, "Well, I'm fine." She said, "Do you have anything you can give me?" I said, "Well, what did you have in mind?" She said, "Mr. Hudson, I don't care." Said, "Just anything." Said, "I was sick in bed when the looting was going on, and I didn't get nothing." And at the first thought, it made little daggers just jump out like that. And then thank goodness we've got a deal that's on the wall that says think, think, think. I said, well, I got to thinking Martha Jackson wouldn't come knock those windows out. But if they were all knocked out and everybody was looting, she'd feel as she had as much right to it as anyone. Do you know I gathered up a few things and took them over to Martha Jackson? And that's because of think, think, think. Well, that happened in October. The day before Christmas of that same year, my wife gave me a grocery list to go to the grocery store to buy a few items. There's three things I didn't like then, and there's three things I don't like today. I don't like to go to the post office and have them taking a break, and I have to stand in line if I can see them. If you take a break, fine. But you get out of my sight. I don't like to go into a bank 10 o'clock in the morning and they've got some cages already out to lunch. And I sure don't like to go into the grocery store and have to stand in line and they don't have all the check stands open. I don't like that. Didn't like it then. Don't like it now. And that day, the first stop I had to make was the post office to mail a package back to North Carolina. And I had to stand in line. Now, I'm sure the moon had something to do with it. I'll bet you it was a full moon. I've never looked it up. And then when I got to the grocery store, they didn't have all the check stands open, and I had to stand in line, and I was furious. And I got home. Emotionally, I had to go to bed. I was just torn up so bad. I was in there about 30 minutes, and I got to thinking, you know, that package I should have mailed 2 weeks ago, it's not going to get to North Carolina tomorrow. You knew you was out of money. Why'd you wait till the day before Christmas to come in and get money? And as much as you know about the grocery business and you go in there the day before Christmas, why didn't you buy your groceries a week ago? And you know, I started laughing at myself because all of these things could have been avoided. And I bring that story up against the riots when I had lost everything I had. As I would sit there and watch people ride my bicycles off, roll my automobile tires off, carry off my televisions, and did not have one thought about taking a drink. Not one thought. And here I get so upset. So it just reminds me that elephants don't bite, mosquitoes do. And it's the mosquitoes that has given me the problem since I've been in this program. I can handle the big stuff, but it's in the drip, drip, drip that just will tear you up. So I have to remember that. Elephants don't bite, mosquitoes do. Now I want to tell you a story about my sponsor. My first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous was a busboy in the El Cortez Hotel. The first probably businessman that probably ever walked on the face of the earth. Now, I'm not telling you people anything that I hadn't told him many times. My attorneys had already come up with the fact that I had to take bankruptcy. There was no way out. My CPA had come up and said there's no way out. The bank that I already owed money to come up and said you have to take bankruptcy, there's no way out. My sponsor George in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous said if you want to take the easier, softer way, go ahead and take bankruptcy. But if you want to use the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, you won't have to do it. I said, George, I don't know what the principles are. He said, the principle you've got to use in this is honesty. The principle of honesty. He said, you go to these people and you look them in the eyes and you tell them the truth. Tell them there's no way you can pay them, but you will. And don't go promise them anything that you can't do. And the people you can't see in person, you get them on the telephone. The people you can't get on the telephone, you write them a letter. He said, how many people? I said, there's 45. How many of those 45 do you think went with me when I done what he told me to do and use the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous? 44. Only one person that I never could make contact with. I hope he found our program because he done the same thing that I used to do. I wouldn't answer my door, I wouldn't answer the phone, and I wouldn't answer my mail. And I hope he found our program because he's the only one that I paid off. And George told me, he said, you go to these people, and he said, sometimes you might only can pay them a dime, but you pay them that dime. And then he told me that I could pay all this off in 7 years. I said, George, I can't even make that kind of money in 7 years, much less pay off this loan. Well, I went to work on it. Stayed in Las Vegas another couple of years. Left Las Vegas driving a U-Haul trailer. But I was happy. Big, big time in debt. Moved to Texarkana. Been in Texarkana a little while and I went up and asked the bank I was doing some business with about getting my loan transferred there because the interest was going to be about 3 to 5% less, and they bought my loan. When it got down to 6 years and 11 months and I could see that I could pay this off in 7 years, I let some people go and paid it off in 6 years and 11 months to prove that George could be right if I used the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. That has been a great relief. George asked me, he said, is there anything that's been left out that might get you drunk on down the road? I said, one thing, George. I said, me and the insurance company fought over this, and it's one thing that they wouldn't pay me for. I said, I'd collected about $4,000 for layaways. and they would not pay me for those. They said that that was a sale when I made it, when I laid them away. I said it was a sale when I got the money for it. But anyway, he said, "You think you can get the money?" I said, "I don't know, but I'll go." And I went to the CEO of the Bank of Nevada and told him what I was trying to do and what I wanted to do. And I said, "I have no cap, no more collateral, you know that." And you know, he loaned me the money to pay these people off. And I'm so happy that he did. He just put it on the same note. Because I know that sooner or later, that could have come back to haunt me. My wife's mother got real sick while we still lived in Las Vegas. She had to go back to Texarkana. We was going to bring her to Las Vegas to live with us. And she had been back there about 2 weeks. She called me one night. She said, "The doctors tell me that I need to get in touch with my brother." She had two brothers. "That mother is fading fast. And she's not going to be here long. And they need to be here." And said, "We can't find Lee." I tell her oldest brother. Said, "We don't know where he is." Said, "We have looked." Said, "I thought maybe he might have called collect." And said, "I've looked through telephone records and what have you. And there's been no contact in several years." The next night I was getting ready to go on Friday to the Palm Springs Roundup. And I wasn't going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, on Thursday night. I was going to go back to Sotoma. I had rejoined Sotoma after I sobered up. And I was trying to do 5 days worth of work in four, because I was working on commission. I went to Sotoma. Honestly, I believe God drove that car. I only stared that night, and he drove the car. Because I ended up on my way home in front of the clubhouse. And I thought, what am I doing here? But since I'm here, I'll run in, I'll have a cup of coffee, and I'll go on home and get my orders together. And as I walked in the door, there was a guy from California who'd been coming to a lot of our meetings. And he said, "Oh, Joe, I'm glad you're here." Said, I didn't think you were going to be here tonight." Said, "I got to take a fifth step." And I thought, "Oh, God, no, not tonight with all I got to do." I said, "Well, you got to do a four step first." He said, "I got 18 pages and I got to get rid of it." I said, "Come on." We went back into our general office and I locked the door. That man hadn't talked 5 minutes till he mentioned my brother-in-law by name. I can't tell that story tonight that the hair don't rise up on my arms. Because that was God. There's no doubt about it. I let him finish. And I said, "This Lee Flowers that you mentioned when you first started about the not paying him for candy, I said, do you know where he is now?" He said, 10 months ago he was on Pacific Boulevard in the 1000 block. It's Curry's Ice Cream and Candy Store. I got home about midnight. I called the next morning early. I got a hold of Lee. He answered the phone. I told him about his mother. He said, "I can't leave today, but I'll leave as quick as I can." He come in on Monday. I come in on Monday. And Lee was in the room with his mother at 5 o'clock on Wednesday morning when she passed away, her oldest son. And I believe tonight that I believe since God through Alcoholics Anonymous found him. I could go on and I could talk about so many things that God has done for me since I've sobered up. I carried one resentment for 56 years. Brought it into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was against the Red Cross. When we got back from overseas in 1943, I hadn't been paid in 4 months. None of my buddies had been paid in 4 months. And we come into Charleston, South Carolina. And I wanted to borrow a dollar to call home. I hadn't had any mail from home in 4 months because I'd been in the hospital jumping around and wasn't in one place long enough for the mail to catch up with me. I wanted to borrow a dollar, and they refused me. And I went in, and basically this should have probably lasted 20 minutes, but it lasted over 56 years. Because a man from Rutherford County that I could throw a rock from where we lived to his house had got a job at the shipyards, and he knew everybody that come in on those hospital ships, and he saw my name. And I was laying on that bed about 20 minutes, and I told him my story. He said, let's go make the call. And that's probably when it should have ended, but it didn't. I guess I like to talk about it. I don't know. But I brought that into Alcoholics Anonymous. My group, I didn't tell you, my home group is the Duluth group. It's a book study group. We meet on Tuesday night. And we were studying the stories. And this was on the 24th of August, 1999. And it's the man that started Alcoholics Anonymous in Chicago that had come down to spend a couple of weeks in Akron. And the last afternoon he was there, Dr. Bob spent with him and went over, and his story was in the big book, and it's on page 292 in the third edition, that it says, told him about getting rid of having these six steps is what they had, and then told him about getting rid of all the sarcasm and all of this and resentments. That night when we left the study group, I said, gentlemen, I've got one resentment that I'm going to get rid of tomorrow. I'm going to the Red Cross, and I'm going to get rid of it. The next morning at 10 minutes after 9, I walked through the front door of the Red Cross building, and I went back and I gave him a donation. And I went home and I told my wife about it that night. She said, how much did you give him? I said, I gave him $50. She said, you should have given him $100. She said, that was a big one. Nothing was ever good enough for her. The next day, she had a doctor's appointment to go have some blood work done, which she went and had done. She went to a grand opening of a dollar store and was home when I got home for lunch. We had lunch. I went back to work about 1:30, and about 2:30, the lady that was doing some work for us that day called me and said that she had a hurting over her left kidney. And I said, well, call the doctor and see if you can get in to see her or see him. In a few minutes, she called back and said, we're going to the doctor. About 3:15, I got a call that she had fainted in his office and that they was taking her to the hospital. I headed to the hospital, and I got there just after they got there with her. We went in, and she knew me. But she said, I'm cold, and I'm hurting. I'm hurting, and I'm cold. Well, I knew it was all over by looking at her. She had an aneurysm, and she was dead at 5:20. Well, she knew. I got rid of the resentment. I don't recommend this, that you hold on to them that long. Because we do have tools in order to get rid of them in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you know, you have to drink alcohol in order to be an alcoholic. You have to stop drinking alcohol if you want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That seems, it is hard to get over sometimes to some of our people. But you know, Alcoholics Anonymous will work. If you don't believe it, you try. If you don't believe God will help you, you ask Him. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.